Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Adulting Well show. I'm your host, Joshua. I'm here with Kevin, and we're doing something a little different this time. We just finished recording our Ian MacKay episode, and we're kind of decompressing from that, and I thought we would just chat for a bit before this one. What do you think, Kevin?
I think it's a great idea. So a couple of quick things. We did not do any kind of pitch at the end, so I just wanted to remind people that we're donating money to Hospitality House SF through the end of the year. If you give some money to our Patreon, that's where it will go. Check them out, hospitalityhousesf.org.
You should say why we weren't able to do that.
Because I was a little excited.
We ended up talking for like what, 45 minutes? It just kept going. We ended the show and we were doing our normal, like, okay, here's how the tech works. Like, don't, you can close your browser, whatever. Right. And then he just started telling stories.
Yeah. Yeah. We stayed on the air with Ian after the interview, and I wish we would have recorded it.
I know.
Cause it was fantastic. But you know what? It was also nice to get that like personal moment and talk about some things that maybe weren't necessarily for air, you know.
Right.
So it was a fantastic interview. I've been a fan of his music as long as I can remember. Yeah. And
it's
and
always good to tell people about stuff they can't listen to.
And that isn't me being a guess what we got to do. I just was like so overwhelmingly excited. Yeah. I didn't want to hang up. So it was a great interview, I thought, and he's just a really right on guy, and it just was a lot of fun.
So I thought it was powerful because you told me that your father just passed away right before we recorded this interview.
Yes.
So you're kind of on the heels of that going into what I imagine for you was a very big personal interview for you, like a big moment for you.
It was. And my dad was one of those dads that came to see my bands play, as much as he did not like the music that I was playing. He was, you know, he was a hell of a guy. I actually posted his obituary on Facebook for his friends and our family and other people. And it's just the outpouring of love and support has been almost completely overwhelming. Like I knew he was a good guy and I knew he had a lot of community, but I had no idea. Like I really, like, you know, people the way you know them. And my dad and I were really close.
Yeah.
We were close with each other. Like, you know,
you knew him as your dad. You didn't know him maybe as this guy.
Yeah. So, you know, we've gotten a lot of, my mom has gotten a lot of emails and a lot of letters, a lot of flowers, a lot of love. And, you know, I can't actually put into words how truly impactful it is right now, especially with such little personal, you know, connection face to face.
Sure.
It's been really nice. And I think, so I'd like to also dedicate this episode to him because I think he would have liked Ian. I think they would have probably stayed on the phone longer than the three of us did, telling stories to each other. And, you know, they definitely both have the gift of storytelling. So I just like, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, there's just a lot to unpack when a parent dies, and, you know, mm-hmm. and I don't want to make light of it either. It's a very, very somber time for me, but you know, this show working with you on this show and this episode, especially right now, was really meaningful. And it kind of is one of the things that keeps me going. So, I just want to say to everybody that listens, thank you for listening to our show. It really means a lot to me. And our interviews are very personal. And we don't filter anything out unless specifically asked by a guest that we take something out. But that
even I might point out when I put my foot in my mouth, I don't erase
it. We don't erase it. And so they're very personal and they're very whatever is, you know, currently going on in the person's, you know, kind of stream of conscience. And it's, you know, it's a very different way, in my opinion, to do these kinds of interviews, because I know a lot of them are incredibly curated and, you know, questions are sent beforehand. And, you know, so I really love what we do. I think it's really honest. And you know, I appreciate everybody that listens. So,
Kevin, thanks so much for setting some context. But I think there's only one real question here. What's Did your dad prefer Engage or Siren?
I think he preferred Siren. Him and Brian and Joe Carr were very close.
Joe was close with Brian Zero.
My God, my dad loves Brian. Loved him.
Brian Zero. I love Brian Zero too. He's definitely one of the weirdest guys I've ever met in my life.
I mean, adored. You know, my parents adore Brian. My mom went to Miriam's memorial actually, and just hugged Brian. Would not let him go.
Oh,
jeez. Yeah. So So I think Siren is the sentimental favorite. I don't think they understood any of it. and we certainly argued over politics at that time. But I will say one thing I will give my dad a huge prop for is he went out his last Facebook. Page his fat last Facebook book photo for his timeline photo or whatever profile photo has a Black Lives Matter banner around it. And apple tree, all that stuff. He was lifelong liberal and was the most inclusive person I've ever met in my life.
That's fantastic, man. What a great way to start the show. Thanks for listening, everybody, and stay tuned for Ian MacKay. Hello, and welcome to the Adulting Well podcast. I am your co-host, Joshua, and I am joined, as always, by...
your co-host, Kevin. And on the show in this episode, we have Ian MacKay. As most of you know, the founder of Discord Records and been in more bands than I can say in one breath. So, Ian, welcome. And thank you so much for doing this relatively late on the East Coast for us. We really appreciate it. I'm super excited to have you on.
Of course, no problem. I just want to clarify that co-founder of Discord Records.
Co-founder, yes.
Yeah. One of four people, really.
Yeah. And that's that actually is important because I know people, you know, all did a lot of work to get that going. So, you know, we briefly touched on your new project before we started the show. But, I kind of want to just talk a little bit about, you know, the state of the world and what it's like for you, because when we chatted on the phone earlier, you were there was a possibility of going doing some family stuff. Kind of how are you doing with things that are going on, having a kid, you know, all the stuff that's happening in the world right now? How is it in DC and Virginia area?
Well, I live in DC and Discord House is in Arlington, which is just across the river. I imagine it's like most of the world. It's, you know, there's a pandemic. The weather is a little bit odd right now. But in general, the way I think about things is that, you know, you just have to dress accordingly. So obviously I don't have any control over the situation in terms of the pandemic. So I have to think, all right, well, I just have to accept that it's occurring and then try to figure out ways to navigate it so that I don't add to the problem, really. So I don't, you know, it's a different life, but I feel pretty clear about things. It's just, you know, just a different set of circumstances at this point. And not to make light at all of anybody who has suffered as a result of the illness or as a result of the economic, you know, problems that are, you know, have occurred and are sure to occur in the future. But I have to say it's like a natural disaster. And when you think about it like that, you know, if it was a flood or a forest fire or an earthquake, you know, these things, who can stop them? So you just have to contend with them. And I guess that's what all I'm doing is contending with them. And I don't know. I mean, Amy and I have a 12-year-old son, but I think that, you know, we've been doing pretty well. We've been hanging in there. And I think one interesting thing is that when the sort of quarantine stuff started, I think a lot of people were really, felt at first, I think were very challenged by the idea that they would be sort of in close quarters with the same people. But mm-hmm. as somebody who is toured and toured and toured and toured, you know, this actually being in close quarters with the same people, you know, I'm kind of used to it. And then having to accept each day as it comes, that's my life.
Right.
So
I think that's a really interesting point, because I've talked to a couple of friends about that. And, you know, I did some touring in my early 20s, definitely not as extensively as you or as for many years. But, you know, I felt like that was like the training ground. The biggest difference right now is this is kind of, I'm not always positive that I toured with people that I totally wanted to be with all the time, but I chose the group that I'm with now. Like fully committed as an adult, this is who I want to spend my life with. So I think it's a really, really good point. What has it been like with Discord during this time? Because I know when I ordered the record, there was some delays with getting it out because of you all not wanting to conflict with your distributor who couldn't open because they're here in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. To me, and maybe it's different for other people, but Discord has always been a very, product sort of, driven record label. Like I love getting the actual record or at one point CD and at one point before that record again, and actually having that tactile sort of thing. How's it been for you to kind of navigate that part of it?
Did you really just skip over a cassette? Were you not a cassette kid?
I was a cassette kid, but
all right. Sounds like you skipped right over that.
I always had an actual phonograph. So
yeah,
my dad was really into records, so that was kind of my thing.
When we put out, I think it was Repeater. Repeater sold something like 70,000 vinyl, like in the first year, and 120,000 cassettes. It was insane. Cassettes were so huge around 1990, 89 or 90. It's bizarre. Like we sold so many cassettes. And then it was interesting because what I remember what that represented was that kids all across the country and then other parts of the world, but especially in the United States, all got cassette players in their rooms.
For sure.
So that's what was selling, cassettes. And then in the early, I say by 94, I think Christmas 94, maybe every kid in America got a CD Walkman or something. Like they got a CD player.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Because
then, can I remember when we did, I think it was Red Medicine. We, this is Fugazi's Red Medicine record. We always had these long discussions about trying to guess how much to press. And I think on Killtaker, which would have been the record before, we'd sold, 150,000 cassettes. But it didn't feel like we were going to sell that many cassettes with Red Medicine. And so we really tried to be super conservative guessing how many to press. And I think we pressed something like 40,000 or something. Mm-hmm. And I remember that it just didn't sell. And at some point, we had something like 30,000 cassettes sitting in a warehouse. And I mean, I've asked this question to people before. But what do you call a record or a cassette that you don't listen to? What's another name for it?
You mean that you never listen to? It just sits around?
Yeah, it never gets listened to.
I mean, it's just like nostalgic crap at that point.
Right. The piece of fucking trash. It really is. And so when we press records, you know, what we really are thinking about when we set pressings is that we realize that what activates these pieces of plastic, whether they're CDs or vinyl or cassettes or whatever, what makes them into something that has some power or some actual resonance is someone listening to it. So right. Anything that you make that no one listens to, you're just adding to this enormous pile of garbage that already exists in the world. And so we've always tried to be very, very thoughtful about how many things to make. We don't want to make trash, period. It's, you know, again, like it's only magical if someone's listening to it.
Was that really part of the thought process at that time?
Absolutely.
That's amazing.
So we are faced with these 30,000 some cassettes sitting in a warehouse, and I had been approached by some people in Poland who really wanted to reissue some of our records on. They wanted to reissue the record on cassette, and also some people in China who were talking about it. So we worked it out to sell them the cassettes we'd already had for 50 cents, which would have been cheaper than what they would have been able to make them, but it was more than we had paid for them, so that worked out. But it was really just seeing the bottom drop out on the cassette market was profound, and CDs just obliterated everything for a while. And then of course now digital has obliterated everything. Even though people talk about the vinyl renaissance, really the vinyl renaissance is a pretty modest renaissance. I think right now the Kuriki record is sold 6,000 or 7,000 copies vinyl, which is for our purposes great, but when you think about the fact that Repeater sold something like 250,000 copies, it kind of gives you a sense of the disparity between the actual physical item. I'm not actually a formatist. Like I don't whatever I don't care. The music, every song I ever wrote, I wrote to be heard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the point. So,
I think that's proof positive by the massive Fugazi digital catalog on your website, right?
Yes. I mean, of course. But I mean, just in general, I think people.
What's funny about that, Ian? Larry Livermore, who we had on the show too, was talking about how he thought it was funny the way like modern punks will do like cassette tapes and like Kinko's flyers and stuff like that. Cause he's just like, that's just all we had. Like, we weren't trying to be. Like, cool.
Kitchen.
Yeah, right. It was just contemporary media at the time.
Right. It was what we refer to as the art of necessity.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really good take. Has obviously then digital has kind of changed how you all do things at the record label.
To some degree, sure. It's just another way. I mean, what I like about physical products is I like the frame.
Right.
I like having here's the record, the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, it's funny with CDs when they came along. It took me a while to figure out what the flaw with CDs was as opposed to vinyl. Vinyl has two sides.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they're 15 to 20 minutes a side. So it's easy to sit down and really give a study to 15 or 20 minutes.
Right.
And then you can, next time you come and you put the second side on, you might listen to those. But CDs, you could fit 70 minutes worth of music. And so everyone put 70 minutes worth of music on there, and there was one side. And if I had been involved with the development of the CD player, I would have had two play buttons. And the second play button would have found the middle point of the CD. Because what you found was that when you sequence an album, a vinyl record, you think a lot about the beginning, the first song, the second song, for both sides. Like, what's the lead off song? But with a CD, it was just the first three songs. And then after that, it was like whatever else. They just kind of threw stuff in there.
Kind of fluffed it.
Right. It just got, and they became, it's funny, especially when you listen to a lot of the early hip hop records, you have the hits up top, and then it was just like 64 minutes of other stuff that was no one can remember, and I think that it wears you out. Like an hour, just listening to for an hour is hard.
For sure. I don't think that also changes how, like, if I think about my favorite CDs, I only kind of know the first four or five songs. Like, when I like all the vinyl records, I know the whole thing because I'd flip them and everything. But my first CDs were, you know, like Elvis Costello's Spike and They Might Be Giants Flood. And it's like, yeah, the first five songs on both.
Right. And that's really, it was a really interesting development. It's something I didn't think about till later, because when CDs first came along as Discord, we were thinking, well, we can take advantage of this format by putting two records on each CD, because they are 70 minutes long. Some of the records were, you know, so we were able to put, say, with Dag Nasty, we put the first record, Can't I Say, and Wig Out, both on the same record.
Right.
We did that with a number. We called them maxi CDs. We'd charge a dollar more for them or something like that. In retrospect, it was, I think, a disservice to the individual albums.
Right.
But at the time, we were really thinking about it. It was like, well, how can we take advantage of this boutique format? How can we take advantage of it to actually offer some like economy to the, in retrospect, I think it was a mistake. And we did try to actually, you know, we reissued a lot of that stuff as separate CDs back when people bought CDs. Now with digital, there's just no frame at all. And right. it's really interesting, because for those of us who make records, if we really think about the sequence, like the Kariki record, we really thought about the sequence. Fugazi, we spent forever thinking about the sequence, like how the arc of the record, you know, and which I, as an aside, I thought I'd bring this up, which I always thought was very interesting as well, which is, do you remember there was a series of bands would get back together and they would do these shows where they would play just this, their most famous record.
One record. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. This one record.
The Spill did that with right. So Perfect then, Now On.
So, and I mean, a number of bands would did it. I saw Devo do it with
Devo did it. That's
awesome. Right. And so, and it was cool, but I was watching it and I go, this is so interesting, because when you think about the arc of a record, like you have side A and side B, and the strong song usually is, you know, the first couple songs on side A, or, you know, and then the first couple songs on side B. The last song on side B is usually sort of like the, like, yeah, oh yeah, here's another song. But at a show, the last song is the encore. It's supposed to, you know, quite right. typically. So when I was watching that show, they played the songs in order, and I thought, it's just weird.
Because you know what the encore is going to be, right?
No, but now you know it. But it's just not the. It's like a toss. It's like an extra, like a song. It was a song they didn't really expect anyone to hear.
Right.
But they sort really of. Funny. And it's really totally interesting. Like what happened. Like
what if you flipped the order when you did? If you did live album concerts, you just did it like flipped.
I mean, I imagine people did that. I only saw one or two of them. The Devo one. I have to say, the Devo one was here in DC, and it was incredible. They did the first record, I think. Oh. Yeah, it must have been the first record. It was great, but it did have this weird ending. The last song was just the last song on side B. But they came out and did an encore of some of their other, like, you know, Whip It, or I don't know, what, some songs that were more like hits.
More popular, yeah.
Right. And then they left the stage. And the show had only been on for like 50 minutes, because a record is only 38 minutes long, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the people, I mean, I didn't pay to get in, but the tickets were like $50 or $60, whatever they were. So people were justifiably and understandably not happy.
Yeah.
Right. And there were more, more, more. And they started chanting more, more, more. And the lights went on and the crowd started chanting, bullshit, bullshit.
Oh, no.
And I was like, this is incredible. Like, what a scene, you know? And then the Devo guys came back on stage in their street clothes. And they did Beautiful World.
Oh.
And Bougie Boy sang it.
Amazing.
And I talked to one of the guys who was working with them, and I said, do they do this every night? And he says, I don't know if they've ever done a show in their street clothes. But they, I think they thought the show was over. And I have to say, it was an incredible moment.
Yeah.
They brought it so... And I actually, it's a band, that's one of the bands, like early on and late, I mean, I started seeing gigs in 79, and I could have seen Devo, but they were at that time, like we were being always ridiculed.
Right.
People would call us Devo. So we just thought like they were this terrible new wave band. And it's one of the bands that I really regret not seeing at that time.
Yeah.
I did see B-52s early on. I saw them right after the Yellow record, and that was an incredible show. Amazing show. But I didn't go see Devo, and I wouldn't have gone to see, I didn't see B-52s the next time, because at that point, you know, we were tired of being called Rock Lobster. So it was sort of like, but in retrospect, I really, really wish I had gone to see Devo, because I think that they were much more, there was something going on there.
Incredible.
Much
band.
More serious.
I saw them at a little place called the Cotati Cabaret. when I was 17, it was an 18 and over show, and my little brother, 16 at the time, talked us in at the door.
Wow.
Because he was just such a huge fan at that time. I mean, he was like obsessed with them.
What town totally. Was this?
Cotati, right outside of Santa Rosa, just north of Petaluma area.
You're up that way. All right.
Yeah, I grew up in Santa Rosa. So, in fact, I saw Fugazi at the Phoenix Theater.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember the Phoenix Theater.
Amongst some other shows around that time. But
Santa Rosa, keeping it real.
Yeah, that's right. That is right. Santa Rosa. And we had, you know, we definitely took a lot of sort of lines out of the Discord playbook in terms of like putting out records. I had a little record label. We only put out stuff from our local bands, and it was fun. It was a fun time. I'm not going to lie.
What was your label called?
Well, I worked with Curb Dog, who did like a bunch of, like, they did some Victims Family stuff, and then they did a bunch of bands that ended up on Lookout Records were on their label.
Like who?
Nuisance.
Uh-huh.
One Man Running. Yeah. There was a few bands that, and then I was in a band called Siren up there. So we hit Brian, our singer, wrote for Maximum Rock and Roll at the time. So
Brian who?
Brian Zero.
I remember the name. Yeah.
Yeah. He did that. He did the whole article with Steve Albini about corporate invasion of the punk scene.
Right.
That big issue. Some of your friends are already this fucked.
Yeah. So, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we had a great little scene up there. Phoenix was a great place to play. We had a couple of local little cafes that would let us do shows. And, you know, actually, I think I booked a Discord band called Los Mordidas to play at our studio.
Yeah. Yeah. Discord related. It was Doug and Chris and those guys. Yeah, they're a great band.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Santa Rosa had its own real unique, like, it was cool. Like, the thing about, I mean, California is such a peculiar state because it really is, like, people, I think, largely think of sort of monolithically, they think of California, but it's such a textured and a wide variety of places, you know, from south to north. I mean, and Fugazi played, we played a lot, you know, we played, you know, we played Chico. We played up in Wairika.
Arcata.
We did Arcata. The Armory. Arcata. Oh, yeah. The Armory, that show?
Yeah, I went to that show, yeah.
What a mess that was. But
that was I think I might have even gone with Chris from Lookout to that show.
Wait, what happened? Can you tell one story? Like, why was that show a mess?
Oh, it was just in an armory, and it sounded terrible. And
it didn't sound good at all.
Yeah, it was just a big, giant hangar, and Northern California punk kids at that time, there's some sketchy kids up there. It was just, there's just sketchy kids everywhere, but Northern California had a really specific kind of sketchiness, you know. I think that, you know, it was an interesting time. I mean, those shows, you know, we would play basically anywhere. I think I took a page out of the Black Flag playbook, which was, you know, Black Flag would go out and do a loop around the country, and then they would, you know, wash their clothes and get back in the van and do another loop, but play the next town over. So instead of playing Washington, they play Baltimore. Instead of playing, you know, New York, they play Albany or, you know, whatever. It's like they would just play. And as a result, first off, it was like a good inspiration in terms of coverage, but also it just meant that it you know, they had numbers for people, but also it kind of planted seeds. I mean, I have this, you know, and it may not be true. I talked actually not so long ago. I spoke to Joey Shithead about this, but I have a sort of a theory about the way the American punk touring network developed, which was that in the very beginning, you know, of course, the club scene was largely controlled by the industry. So, so the punk bands that came over, like largely bands like, say, The Damned, or even, you know, the Sex Pistols, they were coming through sort of major label stuff, and they were having regular agencies and stuff like that. So they were playing kind of traditional venues. So they would play New York and LA, or they play New York, LA, and San Francisco, or maybe they come to Washington if they want to do a warm-up gig or something. But it was very limited in their touring. The first band that really started to carve out a really unique kind of network was DOA from Vancouver. And I think they were just driven. I mean, obviously an incredible band, but just
great live band.
Yeah, just they just wanted to play. And they were working with a couple of guys. And I don't, I can't remember which one. Maybe it was Laurie Mercer. I don't remember which one. There was a couple of different people they worked with, but one of them or both of them had some connection with the Revolutionary Workers Party, which was a sort of communist, Revolutionary Communist Workers Party. And the Yippies, essentially, like people involved with the Yippie movement in the late 60s, early 70s. And so they toured, and their places they played were largely these weird kind of radical spaces. So DOA played in Washington, D.C. In October of 1979 at a hippie kind of co-op place called Madam's Organ. It's one of my great – I don't know if you guys have regrets about missing shows. I was sick that night. I was sick, and I just couldn't go to the show. And it was – to this day, it's like I have a cassette of the show, and I've listened to it so many times, and it's like one of the shows that I can't believe wasn't there for it. But the fact that they came just blew us all away, that they came to Washington. And then Black Flag, you know, they also come from this strong ethic of playing, but they were largely limited to the West Coast. But they made their way up to Vancouver. And I think DOA actually came to Los Angeles, and Dukowski and the other Black Flag people met them, and they said, you should come to Vancouver. So they went to Black Flag, made it to Vancouver. And I think, and I've actually verified this with Chuck Dukowski, the bass player of Black Flag and the person who booked a lot of the shows. I said, you went up there with a blank notebook, didn't you? And he said, definitely. So he just took all the numbers he could get for all these weird places and started to use that as like the beginning of his network. So he went out and played. Black Flag started touring in 1981. They made their first cross country tour, and they came through, and they had got, and you know, of course they were also, everybody was calling each other. Like I had called, I had called SST, just because we love Black Flag so much, and they had a phone number on an ad. And I just called them in 1980 and said, like, hi, we're from Washington and we love your band. And we just became, you know, we started talking, we talk on the phone regularly. I may have even helped them suggested they play a 9:30 club, whatever it was. But so we ended up having this kind of, it just developed. And then Dukowski, this keeps booking, Black Flag keep playing. And then when Minor Threat starts touring, he just gives me a list of phone numbers, right?
See, that's insane to me because by the time, so I started going to shows in 92. I was a sophomore in high school. But by the time I started, so right around then, I also started hitchhiking around. And it didn't matter if you were hitchhiking or in a band. Like, my first time out of Santa Rosa by myself, I just had some phone numbers and some names that some punks had given me, my friends.
Right.
And I'm able to go to any town and call this number, and there's a punk house, there's shows, there's – it was – amazing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So and I think it still exists, by the way. It's just not phone numbers. It's
email
now
addresses. Yeah, it's email. Yeah.
People are still looking out. I think that, you know, people, I always, punk will never die. It might be called something different, but this sort of the necessity for the underground, that always exists because the overground exists, you know?
Right.
So it's still going on. And like, you know, you're talking about 92. I'm talking about 79, 80, 81. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just of different variations. You know, like there weren't, I mean, by 81, there were these punk houses, but they might've been a little different than the ones you were going to. Like not this, I mean, I'm not saying, I mean, I'm sure they weren't the same houses, period. But I mean, but a slightly different, they weren't like house show, like you're going to house shows, I imagine, to some degree.
Yeah, basement shows.
Right, but we were like in every town there was a house where the punks lived, and that's where you stayed.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's where you would stay. So, and yep. I think, and I could be wrong, but I think Discord House is the sole remaining part of that network. Like the actual, like it's still there. The building is there and it's still basically the same. It's still Discord House. It's, you know, I've had it. It'll be 39 years in October. Right. It's crazy. And I don't think, I mean, some of the other structures might be there, but there's somebody else living, some family in there. I think this, and I think, it's a fucking cultural artifact at this point, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's like a part of something, it's an invisible history.
And I've read just blog posts, random people that have called you guys or you and come out and just done a visit that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there was a period of time where I think we must have been on some weird, tour photo, everybody had to come get their picture on the porch or something.
Yes.
it's true because I kept seeing that. So my funny. Friends would do that too. I don't know what it was, but I've seen those photos.
Reenact the iconic photo of you guys. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But what's interesting now, by the way, just is that I haven't had a single porch photo taken since February.
Hmm. Well, right. Yeah.
And that makes sense. And it's really interesting. You cannot imagine, on any given summer day, usually, I would say it would, sometimes it could be, people would show up every day just to take a picture on the porch. There'd be times I would leave, I'd walk out the front door and there'd be a bunch of people sitting on my porch. It's one of the reasons actually. It is okay. I would say of all the thousands of people that have come, there's been maybe one or two ne'er-do-wells. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. You know, and I will say, though, that one of the reasons, I moved out of Discord House in 2003. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I think I felt like I had to leave that house was that I had become a docent in my own house. People would show up and I'd say, here's this room. Here's the office. Here's where this happened. They're like, oh my God, and that's the porch. And here's where we practice. But also sort of and here's where I shit, it just felt weird. Right. It was my home. Right. And to some degree there was a sense that, I felt like maybe I need to split this up, cause I had been living there at that point for 21 years or 21 years. It was just time to not live there. I love the place. I still, I own it. I go out there, usually 4 days a week or 5 days a week and work. And, it's a great spot, but I'm glad I don't live there anymore.
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, I could see where it would become almost you're tied to it in a way. If you're living there and working there and you've got people stopping by constantly.
Right.
And
it gets
weird. It's like working at Jim Morrison's grave.
I don't know about that.
Not sure about that, but I think what's more interesting about it it was my home, and it didn't feel weird. Like for instance, where you live, you might leave something personal out on your table, for instance, or your desk, because it's your desk. You're not thinking that you're going to be giving tours to people, especially people who are maybe have an exaggerated interest in what you're up to. So they might survey the things on your desk and glean things, even if, I had an experience many years ago where there was a Mormon guy, a kid, and he was a runaway, and he'd shown up at our house, and this is many, many years ago. And he was a nice, very nice kid. And he had left the church, and he was pretty agonized about the whole situation. And as I recall, one of the things that he was specifically upset about was that he was really in love with this, young woman but she was still in the church, and, they couldn't be together because you have to be in the, they'd have to be married. He'd have to return to the fold if they wanted to be married. Anyway, this was going on, and I think he actually left, came back. There's a couple of different times. And at some point he left for good. And I was, I didn't have anything bad to say about the Mormon church. I just was trying to help him navigate. And I get a package in the mail from him. And in there, it's a letter, and it says, when you're ready for the truth, read this. And he had sent a Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. which meant, right, he had gone back. And of course, you know, he had gone back to the fold, which is fine for him.
Yep.
But I don't really need to have the truth explained to me. Right. I know what the fucking truth is for me. So right. I was like, huh. And I put it on my desk and thought about it. I need to think about how I'm going to respond. I'm not going to know. So that's just right. my way. I did an interview at some point with somebody, a fanzine. They came by and they interviewed me. And when the issue came out, the interviewer said, oh, he's a Mormon.
Oh, no.
What?
Because he saw the Book of Mormon on my desk.
Oh, my God.
And then that explained, like, my ethics or whatever in his mind. And so this is where you start realizing, like, it becomes a really delicate kind of situation when your personal life is all tied up with where people come to look.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you ever noticed, like, if you ever seen interviews with me on a video or in a movie or something, almost always I'm sitting in the same place at Discord yes. House. And and if you check it out, I sit in a neutral corner. There's yeah. nothing in the background except those windows, and you might see a car parked. You might see some leaves out the window. But there's nothing behind me because I just realized that's the neutral corner where people can't try to figure out like what it is I'm reading or what, right. you know, mm-hmm. or whatever, right. whatever, you know. So it just became my spot to do interviews. Plus it's good light.
Well, it's such an interesting perspective too, because I know I'm not really sure that I would want anyone taking a snapshot of my bedside table at any given time and see all
that's
what I'm
funny,
reading.
Kevin, because I just realized if I ever get interviewed for some reason, I'm going to leave the weirdest books out now.
You know, because who knows? Because I read a lot of different things about a lot of different things, and I'm an avid reader. I just, you know, and I've actually read part of the Book of Mormon. Right. I'm certainly not a Mormon.
Right. There's no issue. That's the thing. There's no issue. It's mostly how they're interpreting things. It's their filters. That's all.
Well, and in some ways, I guess you could see where it would line up. I mean, given the fact that they're like the no drugs or smoking or, you know, drinking, like they would be, oh, of course, because people want to look for something that makes more sense to their brains other than that's just your ethos, right? Like
I am. It's not that. No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think that, I think there's human beings like to connect the dots.
They do.
Yeah. And I'm not mad. Honestly, I'm not even mad. I'm happy. I hope I never heard from that guy again, the Mormon guy. Right. I hope his life is good. Like I don't wish ill on anybody. I'm not even really mad at the interviewer. What I came away with was a lesson about how, like, I think, you know, I'm a thoughtful person about, you know, how I conduct my affairs. And there are a lot of times where I make a decision about how to approach something, which is really largely based on the idea that I don't want to spend a lot of time later on explaining it, because it's a waste of time having to sit there and like, no, you misunderstood this. I mean, one thing I can't stand is when people float nonsense rumors that then I have to deal with.
Right.
It just drives me nuts because I have other things to do. I don't want to have to explain, I'm not going to make any examples right now, but there have been over the years a number of hoaxes or things that was, I have to, like, people will call me and they're like, what happened or what's going on? I'm like, okay, here's the situation. And it's just ridiculous. I'll give you a good example, actually. Here's an example. Some years ago, the weekly paper here, contacted, somebody at Discord and saying, hey, somebody did a blog thing about the fact that Urban Outfitters are selling Meyer Threat shirts. And so the weekly, because they're so starved for stories, I guess, you know, the content, damn it. They called and they said, is this true? Can we verify this? And I mean, it was true, but the Meyer Threat shirts had been selling in Urban Outfitters for I don't know how long, because I don't care. It's not, basically the way it works is that each band decides for itself how they want to proceed in terms of merchandise. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Fugazi, we do not make merchandise. In the case of Minor Threat, it's a democracy. I was outvoted. So fair enough. I don't have any problem with it. And there was a company that made these t-shirts and they sell the shirts to whoever they sell them to. It doesn't matter to me because I think shirts are, I think they're ridiculous anyway. You know, like I don't wear band shirts. And I mean, I think if a band makes some shirts and they want to sell them to get them down the road, cool. I'm all for it. But if people are buying clothing as a status symbol, I find that not so interesting. So this reporter kept calling, going like, well, can you verify? And then we just, I think I just wrote back. It's like, I told the guy, just tell him, you know, yes, whatever. And then they wanted to comment. And finally, she called a couple times. And I just picked up the phone and called her. Well, she was texting or writing or whatever. So I called her and I said to her, I don't care. Like, I just don't care about this. It's not important. I go, you know, I don't know why, like, to me, I don't know why it makes more.